Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solution Project in collaboration with Shoshin Works, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are now reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and they're reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping societal systems of governance and network orchestration. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being updated, and they're being replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era. I am Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I am the former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at General Electric. My expertise lies at the intersection of economic trends with technology and innovation. I am joined today by Rob Auten. Rob is the co-founder and CEO of Hexagram, where he's part of a team blending human-authored stories into AI simulation-powered worlds, creating applications for games, live entertainment, and hospitality. Rob has also written for acclaimed video game franchises such as Gears of War, Tom Clancy's, and Battlefield, and has created toys for Disney Imagineering. Rob, welcome to the podcast. If you want to add anything more about your background, otherwise, let's launch right into it.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you for having me. That's great. I'm sure your audience is already wondering why a video game writer is here talking about AI and simulation. And these are topics that for me have been fascinating, not just since the recent release of all the LLM models, but something that I and my colleagues at Hexagram have been looking at, specifically simulation and sort of improving the relationships between characters in a game and the players of that game. And we sort of started with that mission of like, how can we create more in-depth personalized relationships with characters? And then from that, that became, how can we kind of create communities of characters? And now all of a sudden, the potential of those communities is really something that's coming into the spotlight because of LLMs and because of this race towards the AGI that everybody calls it. So yeah, I'm very excited to talk about this with you today.
That is very exciting, I think. But I actually don't think that the audience was wondering why we had a video game developer. I think they were excited by the idea that we had a video game developer on. And so you mentioned the generative AI. Why don't we start with the aspect that I think I find most intriguing in your current efforts, based on the previous conversation you and I have had. We expect a lot from artificial intelligence, especially generative AI, but so far it has struggled to really realize its full potential. In particular, it's not been able to impress us by solving big real-life problems. And I think part of the issue seems to be that generative AI doesn't have a model of the world, partly because it doesn't inhabit the real world yet. It inhabits mostly the internet and social media. And that, if I understand correctly, is something that your technology is starting to address.
Well, the race for a world model has been around for some number of years now, and I'm really far, as I said, and I will keep insisting to keep myself and everybody else honest, I'm far from an expert in that particular, in the particular technicalities of exactly how world models are created. But as I understand it, there are kind of two different pathways towards building a world model. And one we would call, and I'm making these terms up, I would call it an envisioned reality, which is similar to something like Sora, where it's essentially analyzing video and producing video, and that video can then be used to inform the actions of an agent, whether that's a robot or an NPC in a game. And then there's what we call simulated reality, which is essentially taking a game engine and then improving the physics, improving the sociality, using it to kind of help people create productive behaviors. And then you can layer and then you can derive all kinds of analysis from that. And that's taking place within a 3D game engine as opposed to a video file, right? And so that means that the agents within that 3D world can be machine powered or they can be human powered. And so there's a lot of different ways when they're human powered, especially initially, there's a lot of different ways that you can analyze things like the tone of voice and the actual statements being made by the players. And from that, you can kind of get you can get a sense of the emotion and the emotional change in the players. And so you will know or you will learn that when one player insults another player, which is an antisocial behavior, that the player who received the insult may react in any one of a number of different ways. And what we're kind of doing with my colleagues at Hexagram is taking these kinds of actions and quantitizing them into sort of discrete computer code. And so there's still, because of the nature of each individual personality within the world, which there's many different qualities that a person might have, and those are born of, they could be something that were inherited from their parents, it could be something that they learned during their simulated rearing. All of those different qualities affect the way that they see the world, and they affect the way that they would react to the world. So what we're attempting to do is create sort of a, what we call like a social simulation, that into which a single player can enter and get the sense, when they're communicating with other characters in the world, that they have this sense of context, that they know what's going on around them, and they have, as you said, an idea of the way that the world works. And this, to your point, is something that an LLM alone cannot, and probably, I dare not to say, will not be able to ever produce, but certainly the LLMs that we're dealing with today, one can imagine, given that they're only really able to process written text, and certainly there are connotations and things that can be learned from that, from text alone, but it's not really the same as getting out into the world. And so there's, I'm one of a number of people who believe that as we move towards sort of the next turning of the wheel of artificial intelligence, that may be powered, or in the future may be powered, by something more akin to this sort of world model. And so, yeah, the work that we're doing is very simple and very discreet, and really initially focused towards gaming applications. But we've come to realize that actually, once you can create sort of a simulation, especially of like a closed environment, so something like a hotel or a village, you would be able to better model the world in a sense of context for the characters within that world using similar tools.
This is bringing us closer to some of the interesting applications of this, right? Because first, obviously, what you're describing is a much richer and more interesting and rewarding gaming environment. But as you point out, at the moment when you expose the artificial intelligence to a richer and more realistic kind of human interaction and societal development, the artificial intelligence learns more. So what are some of the implications beyond the gaming? How do you see this kind of technology or the lessons of this being deployed?
Yeah, I mean, and so what we see is, we see, you know, that there's this other space that can be created, and in some people have labeled it the dream world, right? And so the dream world is sort of like the world in a film like The Matrix. It is this sort of simulated pseudo-reality in which any one of a number of different scenarios, be they on the civic scale, a social scale, the actual underlying physics of this world, all of which are manipulable, right? So once you've taught a system to understand, and one of the limitations of these systems, particularly the sort of envisioned reality systems that are using things like video as inputs, is if you change the lighting in a room or something like that, then it's unable to kind of repeat the same pattern that worked the first time, right? So you have to build for a certain amount of dynamism in your simulation. And for things like video, obviously you can capture the same input at 30 or however many, infinite number of lighting conditions, but you're still limited to the input data. In a simulated environment, you have a lot more, you have not only the ability to compress time, but you have a lot more tools that you're to actually simulate that light, not just kind of placing lights in discrete positions and then sort of running the sample again. So yeah, so the application really is, you know, theoretically extensible to just about anything where you would like to kind of attempt to predict what would happen in a situation, right? So for things where there are, obviously customer experience is important, right? Hospitality, super useful. For things like training, for things like, and whether that's an interaction with a customer or specifically for your audience, something going on in some kind of vehicle, right? And chaos is going to happen. It is inevitable. It's really hard for envisioned and video-based models to simulate chaos in a believable or useful way, whereas through simulation, once you've kind of reached a specific level of detail in the physical world, which is to say the underlying physics of that engine, such that you can realistically replicate chaotic trends, right? Then you have the ability to really get, and again, you can repeat these simulations millions and millions of times in a very compressed time scale. So you have the ability to run a model that has a certain sort of chaos factor in it and see multiple different outcomes and then sort of learn to understand which ones are more probable. So the benefits there are obviously quite exciting.
I see from your smile, it's obvious how huge the potential of this is. And your analogy to The Matrix is particularly evocative. And it talks about, it speaks to the possibility, as you said, of better training, but also better training and better simulation that hinges on our ability to describe and replicate correctly the environment. So you've talked about two aspects of it. One, the human environment, so the way that people's reactions are, the emotions that come out, which can be very useful to train for customer interaction. The other one you mentioned is the simulation of the physical reality of a particular space. How difficult, how challenging is it to create realistic assumptions for specific spaces?
Yeah, both of these things are incredibly difficult in each their own way. And so on one hand, game engines and people, I mean, people like the folks at Epic behind the Unreal Engine, for example, are obsessed with getting the physics right. I think in to some level, and I mean, having worked there and having some exposure to some of the key people there, the idea that you're making games with the engine is sort of secondary to the engine's ability to potentially simulate reality or a new reality or a different reality or a better reality. That is what gets these guys out of bed in the morning. I mean, as far as it's been reported to me, at least. So that's hard. And it's interesting because it's measurable, right? So one can theoretically create a really amazing physics system and get a sense of where it's deviating, where it's failing, or where, and so there's always something to pursue, right? On the emotional side, it's undefinable, right? It's a sort of an infinite problem space because no one really can predict what another person is feeling or the words that's going to come out of another person's mouth. And I think one of the most interesting things that's been going on, and I don't know the strategy, so I can't actually, this is just a guess, but as Meta has positioned itself towards 3D virtual worlds and its Horizons platform, it's also brought about with its hardware, with its headsets, this shift in interactive gaming of any type towards sort of embodied reality and towards more social gaming. And so a lot of the games that you see that are doing really well on platforms like the Quest or things like Gorilla Tag, they're social games. And as much as possible, they're measuring the way that we actually move our bodies. And they involve physics and picking things up and throwing. And so what I would imagine they're doing, or I'm sure they will certainly start soon if they haven't already, and I'm pretty sure they have, is starting to take all of the data, not just in terms of the way that we move, but in terms of the way that we interact, react, or the way that, again, the way our voices change when we smile, when we're happy, when we frown, when we're upset, we squint our eyes. As the new headsets give us better ability to read these faces and encode things and things like the facial action coding system, stuff like that, we will be building a library of emotion, both micro expressions, macro expressions, reactions, and tying correlations between vocal inflections and prosody and the face. And so we won't know exactly what's going on. If you're interacting with a really good poker player in the metaverse, you may not know exactly what they're thinking, but I mean, you certainly will be able to get a sense from other AIs of how they're feeling and that they should be able to start to react in a much more realistic manner. Again, this is an infinitely deep well. And both these problems are kind of on an axis with one another and very much in the truly hard problem arena. But we are starting to see innovative companies really chisel away.
Indeed. And it's very exciting because that this last point you've touched upon does really open the door, as you were saying, to the next phase of artificial intelligence and potentially to artificial intelligences that can interact with us in a much more natural way, so a much more credible way, even with empathy, one might say, if they really have this better understanding of our emotions and our reactions. I think we can get into some of the potential applications of that as well. I'm wondering, in economic setting, in industrial settings, do you see the potential for these simulations to help us understand and anticipate better what might happen, for example, on a factory floor, or you mentioned the hospitality industry, or a podcast here is presented by the NASA Convergence Aeronautics Solutions. And it strikes me that once you get really good at simulating physics, there are a lot of scenarios related to the space economy that one might start playing with. How do you see this?
Sure. Definitely on the industrial side. I mean, the predictive maintenance world is already bubbling and for good reason. And I think, and there are plenty of companies who are doing really interesting work on both sort of the individual device level in terms of the overall throughput of a facility, in terms of a network of facility and the logistics and the transport and optimizing all of that. That's all going to continue. And I think it will be the kind of thing where it's incremental gains, and then something will sort of punctuate the equilibrium style, sort of pop up, and then everything will change. And that's less my field, but certainly it's happening, and we'll continue to see that happen. For hospitality is a great example. I mean, we have a partner with whom we've been working for a while, where, I guess without saying too much, but the goal of the project is to create sort of a control system for that monitors the guests and issues orders to the staff of a resort of a certain size, would be relatively restrained. And the goal is, can the system anticipate what a guest will want before it is spoken aloud? Can, when you sit down at your favorite table in the restaurant, the way that you like your martini is, it's, it just arrives ice cold at your table. If you're going out for a run, and as you turn the corner back towards your villa or what have you, either a person or a robot has just dropped a cold glass of lemonade or iced tea or ice water, whatever your favorite beverage is, and has vanished around the corner at the moment that you arrive sweaty to pick it up. I mean, can this be done? Now, should this be done is a separate question. But in a hospitality setting, I think we're not cloning any dinosaurs or anything. So the impact is hopefully relatively low. But it's a really interesting question. And obviously, the thing that you immediately have to come to terms with is, what are you telling the guests? What do they want to know? What do they not want to know? Right? It's like, don't, yes, I'll sign the form. Right? Just, are you selling my data? No? Okay, fine. Like, fine. Just, I just want to have a good time. And then the output of that is like, okay, if you're able to automate, again, whether it's human or machines, then can you use that? And this is where I personally get interested. Can you use that system as a canvas for storytelling or for exploration? Or so can I? And then at what point essentially we get Westworld, right? So it's all this sort of on a continuum, good or bad. But can you reward people for exploring? Can you unlock there's a room in the back of the library, it's just a door, but if you do something, this and this, you trigger these things, you have these interactions, you ask these questions, and suddenly somebody gives you a code or gives you a key that allows you now into this sort of secret back room. And that's all drawing a lot also from the world of immersive theater, where there's massive numbers of people who are sort of at the surface level running around the space. And then there are people by virtue, by luck, by playing the game, by knowledge, who will get pulled into these smaller, more kind of one-on-one interactions. And people really enjoy this. I mean, they will go again and again in hopes of discovering this kind of this greater moment of connection, in this case with a human-driven system. But I think that a lot of that from a narrative perspective would apply to whether there's a continuum between resort and theme park, obviously. And we're trying to much more do sort of the resort with the story rather than theme park all out. But anyway, so yeah, I think the application's there from a just economic perspective, from a sort of persistence or engagement perspective, replayability perspective, and then just from a depth of emotional and leading to empathy, whether it's from or for. I mean, I think it's equally almost as impressive to have characters really care about an AI. And I think we're still at a level of interaction where for most people, they see it as something that they're going to try to break, or they're going to try to minimize their interaction with it because they just like, you're either just give me a human, I want a human, the AIs don't understand me. So it's depending on the frame of how it's presented and what its function is. But what we found when we were doing AI characters 10 years ago, with just an open parser and hi, I'm this guide character, a lot of people would try to break it. And so what we did is if you were rude to it, it would just say, that's not appropriate. And it would log off for 5 minutes. And it just, no matter what you said, it wouldn't react, or you couldn't even type for 5 minutes. And then it would come back and it would say something like, well, I hope you're ready to converse a little bit more kindly. And then if you were rude again, it would go away for an hour. And so we had to kind of slap everybody's wrists, you know, every time that they were rude. And eventually people stopped toying with it and just decided to try to play the game. I think we're nearing a point where you're having an interaction with a character, and you should be able to feel as if that character at least has goals that you want to help them achieve. And certainly there are video games that pull that off really well, where people have emotional reactions to the actions of characters in the games. But because you can now ask them to articulate specific reasons, or kind of you having a much more open conversation with the character about why they want something, things you might not have gotten out of a traditional game. I think the door really is much more open for that emotional and empathetic context to kind of seep into these interactions, which will change games and entertainment in general, I think. I mean, fundamentally, I mean, because now you just, every experience can be that much more sort of personalized to the user. And I think it actually brings a new audience into games, or into this sort of new genre of games that didn't necessarily exist, or doesn't necessarily exist today, inside the sort of traditional gaming audience.
It's fascinating at different levels. So the example you were giving of kind of the slap on the wrist of people who try to be rude to the AI, sort of teaching them to engage in a more civil way with the AI, strikes me as maybe one way to gradually bring civility back into the social discourse, both online and offline, which is something which would be sorely needed today. There are two or three issues I want to get deeper into with you. You mentioned your example of the resort and the possibility of creating a much more powerful customer interaction where you're able to anticipate the customer's desires and needs. This is kind of the holy grail for a lot of the companies that are now looking at artificial intelligence. So that strikes me like a very fruitful potential application across different industries. You also, you made a reference to Jurassic Park. You quoted Westworld. So I'm sure regulators, if they were not worried before listening to this podcast, will now have a few concerns. Have you already been involved in discussions of regulations? Do you see policy and regulation, or rather, how do you see policy and regulation playing here?
We have had conversations with their partners, very proper and a big fancy law firm. And the first pass is they asked me for, give us all the data you could possibly conceive yourself as ever wanting. So I gave them that. And it was a long list. And then the next call was, okay, this is insane, but can you justify? Because I mean, I was like, give me DNA. I mean, just... And why would you ever want DNA? Well, I can see if people like cilantro, which is the stupidest application of a DNA. But it was, for me, it was more about understanding. I mean, that was a dumb reason as well. But and it's funny because I remember later that part of like one of the subplots of the later seasons or the second season of Westworld was that they were collecting guest DNA, and I'm not even sure what they were going to do with it, and I wasn't even sure what I was going to do with it. But I wanted to see how big of a hoop it would be to get it. And essentially what I was told was, under the current laws, essentially, as long as you are crystal clear with your audience what you are asking for and how you are using it, and they are willing to meet you at those terms, it's okay. So let's say for whatever reason the system predicts that you're afraid of spiders. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. It's impossible to say. But then we want to create a narrative sequence. You're going to put on a VR headset and you're going to see a dream sequence or something that's very immersive, or you're going to be in a room where there's projection elements, and we're going to integrate spiders into that. Again, spiders are scary on a lizard brain level, right? Like, they're on a genetic level. Most of us are afraid of spiders. So it's not surprising to imagine that there would be some kind of reaction. But because there is a reaction, because the model predicted spiders, because there was a reaction to spiders, we would then add to your data structure, your baseball card, fears spiders potentially. And then we would maybe test that, and over time, I don't know what we release spiders into your room. I don't know what we're going to do, but we would test that over time in order to, like, there are ways to kind of identify over to say more.
You realize if I'm a regulator, you're not reassuring me right now.
Fortunately, you're not. And so the regulation and all of this, yeah, maybe a positive example would have been better. But the reality is we are going to be, systems are about to all become tarot card readers, right? We are all going to be guessing, however inaccurately, we'll never know about one another going forward in a way that's far more informed, though not necessarily accurate, than things like the A-B testing that we use today, right? So we're moving from, instead of A-B, it's now A to infinity. And with this personalization and with this nuance that, yeah, you can look for consistency, but to definitively say that something is an accurate prediction is obviously silly. So, yeah. So from a regulatory position, is someone going to say, I don't permit you to make guesses based on data that I'm providing you? Yeah, probably that will happen. I mean, I think there will be some, in the same way that don't track my cookies or something like that, I think there will be some level of like, please opt me out of using AI to optimize my customer experience or whatever that experience may be. And we've, in this project, built for that. And it's because you need to have something. But even then, I think what one would do is you could also kind of identify the sort of like a generic persona that might fill in as a data set for that person. So you're not basing it on nothing. Like it's not just this sort of wraith that's moving through the space. It's okay, cool. We have some very basic demographic information and we're going to just make assumptions about Marco because of that. And they'll probably be even more inaccurate and potentially even more frustrating. But some of that, I guess, you will go through the experience knowing that the experience that you're having is a direct result of the choices that you've made.
That's fascinating. I think the default should be to give access to my data, because otherwise I can see this opening another can of worms, which is the potential for bias. The moment where you treat me not based on my own data, but based on some typical artificial intelligence generated likely model of me, that's going to be open to the suspicion that there might be some embedded bias coming from you, coming from the data.
No, exactly. And that's exactly what, I think that's the problem. If you, right, you'll opt into an extremely, much more likely to be biased structure that represents you as you move through the space, you move through the internet, whatever it is. But yeah, that's a choice we all have to make.
Yeah, exactly. Another question I wanted to ask, you've mentioned the issue of active maintenance in industrial settings and economic settings, which is something that I was very familiar and involved with when I was at GE, and which is essentially using technology to be able to predict when machines will go wrong, and so going and fixing the problems before they actually arise. There's a twin issue, which I think would be also very powerful, and it sounds like what you're doing could be a new powerful tool for this, which is skills building and skills augmentation. So can you help me learn a new job? Can you prepare me if I am in any economic setting? Can you accelerate the process by which I can learn what I might actually have to do?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think the education application across both applied and then even just in the actual like children's education as well, or even the way that children, the possibilities to kind of combine exploration and learning and play. And that's a space that I'm quite interested in. All of that is extensible to developing new skills in someone like a child, or to developing new skills of someone who's been in the workplace but realizes that they now need to, for themselves or because of larger macroeconomic trends, make a switch, right, to a new industry, a new job, a new career. The ability to immerse yourself. I mean, one of the most popular VR games is called Job Simulator, and it takes place in the future where a human has been kind of brought in to perform jobs the way that they were performed in sort of in our era. And so there's like a fake office where you have to like pretend to type on a keyboard and stuff like this. And so it's very tongue-in-cheek and very clever. You're being trained to perform the duties of a human circa 200 years in the past in that game. And I think there's been all sorts of really promising fits and starts towards kind of combining AI and XR technologies. Most of the time it's VR. I can't say that there's no one platform or one definitive leader in that really springs to mind, but I think there's a lot of people creating bespoke solutions for selective industries who are willing to kind of spend that R&D money and put these people into these programs to teach them these new skills. And then obviously there's the whole, you can't not mention robots, because everything that's being used to train humans will obviously in a much different manner, but you know, using some of these different kind of world models will be used to train these robots. So yeah, just everybody keeps saying, if you're going to pivot from a career level, make sure that it's something that's not as easy to train a robot on, at least for the foreseeable future.
And sometimes that's not very easy to tell, right? Because
it's true.
Sometimes
they sneak up on you.
They stick up with you, but also something that has always amused me as an economist, right, pay special attention to the economic study, and you have professional economists who routinely come up with these theories and simulations and statistics on how many jobs and which jobs will be taken away by robots and how quickly and how soon. And while there's no doubt that automation is something that is happening, will continue to happen, and needs to be taken seriously, and we need to figure out how to train people better for jobs that will remain, it's striking to see how people are completely blindsided in this analysis by the fact that they don't really understand what different jobs entail. So you look at it abstractly and you think, oh, that's a job that can very easily be taken over by a robot. And then you turn around and you realize that no, actually, because maybe there is, you know, 80% of the tasks in that job can be automated, but there's a 20% that is crucial and that cannot. And so the human has to remain involved.
Well, another one, I mean, just to give another negative example, since I'm on a roll, lawyers. I think I've been surprised by, there are things that LLMs can do well and things that they can't. But one of the things that some people have been getting surprisingly good results out of is because you can feed in the things like case history into a system and then ask it to make decisions or prepare arguments based upon that history. And I mean, knowledge of the law obviously is a key part of being a lawyer, but that's something that's very easily, and the ability to extrapolate and interpret that knowledge is obviously the human component. But to have a system that has an exhaustive knowledge of the law, and then even to be able to ask it to kind of just put little pins and strings on the board and make simple connections, it's quite capable, seemingly, at doing that. And I don't think lawyers have to start signing up to become plumbers or handypersons anytime soon. But I mean, it is interesting to think that you have these brain skill jobs that I think everybody thinks robots and they imagine machine lines. I don't think that they imagine this sort of more, what everybody thinks are more sort of cognitively exhaustive jobs, or, you know, sort of, I don't know, house, but yeah. And so it's interesting to see that those worlds be some of the first to kind of hit the crosshairs of these innovations.
Rob, we talked about the simulation of physics in these simulated worlds. And I think you mentioned at the beginning also the possibility of playing around with it and simulating different physics. Do you see there also as a potential for us to start understanding better how things could work either in space or on different planets? I'm just thinking of science fiction has done a lot of work in trying to figure out what happens if we try to colonize Mars. Wouldn't this kind of simulations be a much better way of doing it?
I am sure that somebody has already cracked this, or it's hard at work on it. I mean, I know, for example, in the Middle East, there's a Mars project that is sort of similar to the Biosphere 2 project from some number of years ago. That is, it's a physical structure that is attempting to simulate on some level some of what it might be like to actually live on Mars, which I find completely fascinating. But I think the probably quicker and maybe not as, well, maybe accurate and less accurate in different ways, but yeah, you know, simulation physics is, in these worlds, physics is a slider, right? Or it's a series of sliders. It's a series of equations, all of which are very easily transposed up, down into potential realities and into things that could theoretically never happen. And physicists have been using some level of simulation in their practice for obviously for a long time, for a different kind of simulation, social simulations that we're talking about today. But yeah, in terms of being able to simulate another environment like Mars, like other stars, worlds on other stars, even the environment inside the vehicles that we would use to get to these worlds. Yeah, I mean, game engines are quickly becoming the closest sort of and readily accessible thing. I mean, you can download these tools for free, which is astounding. And some of the best tools that we have for these kind of, for at least the imagination to explore. And I think we still have a ways to go on our math in terms of like purportedly realistic simulation, but certainly, I mean, there are games that already contain tens and tens of thousands of explorable worlds, each with different variables that you can buy off the shelf today.
It's a very important point that the issue of scale and numbers. And one thing you mentioned earlier also having to do with the time, you mentioned that in these simulations, time is essentially not an issue. It's not a constraint because you can run so many of them that you can accumulate enormous amount of data and knowledge. Now, talking about space and Mars and other planets, it is something that I think will probably be especially powerful, which is the ability to simulate together new physical realities together with the human interactions and behaviors and emotional reactions, right? Because again, think of the issue of colonizing Mars. Again, science fiction will describe what happens when the first team of people goes there, settles, and how they interact with each other and how the different stresses created from the environment by the environment impact their behavior. But even if we think of more near-term and earthbound technological developments, it sounds like with these simulations, you could, for example, envision a world where technology has changed completely. Everybody works from home. There are only autonomous vehicles, you name it. And then throw it in and see what happens actually to people's behavior and see. And you might be able to glean some of the unintended consequences and impacts, which otherwise we cannot foresee. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I think it's great to think of these systems as ways to test the imagination, but they're not replacements for the imagination. So the world that you suggest is absolutely something that would be simulatable in a world such as this. And specifically, what we're looking to do is both create the simulation that has those rules and powers that kind of world. And so in this world, it essentially would become impossible for a human or an NPC or an AI pretending to be a human to drive a vehicle, right? It's not allowed. And that's easy to kind of coordinate off those sorts of things to see then what happens. If somebody's car breaks, do they call someone? Do they have to walk? Do their phone dies? And then what do they do? And we can create, and so we have two different systems. One is called, which was created by our colleague, Dr. James Ryan, which is called story sifting. And story sifting is the process of taking a huge amount of data from a simulation and kind of looking at which elements, which individual actions, and the actions kind of form narratives, and that there are actions and reactions, and that sparks another action. And those can be emotional actions. Those can be physical actions. So somebody can go in an environment and have a really wonderful experience. And then when they return to that environment, whether it's, say, it's a restaurant, they go in pre-tuned to have a good time. They're happy to be there because they loved their first experience so much, right? So that's a reaction just to sort of changes in space. But then essentially what story sifting does is it takes all of these patterns and it looks for the ones that kind of move the needle the most, the equivalent of dropping the big rock into the pond that causes the most amount of ripples, and then says, okay, what was that rock? What is that story? What is that story connected to? What's the tree? What's the thread? And then that, from that, you can sort of feed that to an LLM and say, take this data as a series of actions and turn this into a narrative. And that narrative can be human readable. It can be something you send as an email to your customers. It can be something that becomes a news story in a virtual newspaper. Or it could just be something that as an analyst of the world, it's like, oh, this big event happened today. And this is empirically interesting to me as somebody who's kind of watching over this world. Our specific sort of trick that we're trying to get right here is we expect the simulated worlds to produce stories, and we see very dramatic soap opera style things that are coming and people are seeking revenge and all kinds of crazy stuff is happening. And in order to enable crazy stuff to happen, you allow for crazy stuff to happen. You create actions that describe all the ridiculous things that these characters are doing soap opera style to one another. And then you sort of sit back with your popcorn and watch the simulation produce the narratives. But you can also into that, it create authored narratives that you inject into the simulation. And so those become even more interesting, whether it's just seeing how the characters respond to Godzilla attacking the city, or something like it could be any one of a big seismic literally changes, right? It's something, things are going to happen, people are going to react. And then you can also inject humans into that and say, here's the story, right? Or they will learn very quickly that, like, I'm in this world where the thing that everybody's talking about is the arrival of Prince such and such. And then you become, it's sort of like a role-playing game campaign. You sort of become, you go into the currents of the sort of through line that different other narratives will whirl and eddy off of that current. But you will know when you're in sort of the current that you're in the main story, right? You'll get lots of reinforcement about that story, and you'll become essentially the hero of that narrative, and you can be whatever kind of hero you want. Like you will kind of pluck at the strings of how that story is told, or you can create a terrarium. And as I said before, just sit back and watch it. The choice is really sort of the lean forward, lean back entertainment model. We're expecting that people are going to be more excited by worlds in which that there's sort of a clear goal that they're moving towards, but then the ability to kind of stop and to sort of explore what's off to the sides of that narrative. That gives a certain depth and breadth and allows for almost kind of in game design, like role-playing game behaviors and even sort of like character building and to some level even nurture behaviors or relationships with that character. You're going to help them build their skills so they get stronger, so they can do more stuff, so they can be better at achieving whatever the primary goals are. So there's a lot to it, as I'm sure you can tell.
And the lean forward attitude sounds like the more fun, the more exciting. The lean backwards with your popcorn attitude strikes me as something that might also be beneficial for policymakers. I'll tell you what I'm inevitably thinking of, which is economic policy, where you have two problems. One is that normally you can't simulate really what will be the impact of a specific economic policy. The second is that it becomes very difficult certainly for policymakers to anticipate the possible consequences of a change in policy, even in cases where inevitably ex-post economists will tell you, oh yeah, but it's obvious that if you did this, it's obvious that this other bad thing would happen. Anyway, in hindsight, yes, every economist is brilliant, but for something like this, for example, there's a huge debate on things like universal basic income. And you have people mm-hmm. who say it would be a disaster, nobody would work anymore. And there are people who say, no, it would be fantastic because it will unleash productivity, innovation, and creativity. So if you had a well-done simulation, you could throw in the assumption, universal basic income, get your popcorn, sit back, and if you are the new president of the U.S., try to figure out, okay, can I do it or can I not?
Yeah, and again, this is where I go towards, yeah, I mean, it's the art of that. It's going to be the level of craft that you bring into that simulation is going to determine the success of it as a predictor, right? You're not asking it to create a better economic theory and just sort of trusting it to figure it out for itself. You're saying, given these conditions, and the great thing, again, is that, yeah, they are, certain things are sliders. Give each person this amount of a week, they've given this amount a week, and one path leads to ruin, one path leads to a new utopia. I mean, it's possible. But I do think that we've been really interested, and we haven't done it yet, and we've proposed it to a couple of different organizations where we've built, currently the each character, they have a goal, they have a job, but they don't have a bank account. They don't have a wallet with a certain amount of currency in their pocket. Players have that. And it obviously affects player actions, but it doesn't affect NPCs. It's another level of complexity. But it's something that we've been looking for the excuse to build, because I absolutely think it will be fascinating to kind of watch as this virtual wealth sort of accumulates in different places around the world. And will it end up lining the pockets of a certain segment of the society? Will it end up more evenly distributed? It is absolutely a popcorn. Like, I would love to watch that, the time lapse of this sort of, like, the here's wealth in your environment, because everything can be represented on a map. And so you can literally see as the money moves into the penthouses or whatever, or back onto the streets or whatever it's going to do.
No, absolutely. You could also extend it to figuring out what are the best levers to try to generate more innovation or anything you might think of, green technology or space technology. Governments keep struggling on the question of whether you should do it with subsidies to specific industries, regulations, less regulation, or lower taxes. And as you said, these could all become sliders that you can move around and see how the situation evolves. So, but we have uncovered a huge universe of potential applications.
Yes, it's a tricky road, though, I will say, because, I mean, again, you'll never know that you were right. And that's what makes it so, you're giving people the sense of certainty that because the simulation said this, we made this decision, and you'll never know what would have happened if you had done one click down. But I think the most important thing in the near term is just to try, right? And to look at things like games and kind of the more civic sense, right? Tests, simulations that aren't actually affecting actual policy. But then it's just saying, like, okay, to what level of granularity can we actually see different elements moving, or how much money so-and-so has in their pocket and how that changes over the course of the day, the month? That's the work that's the very hard work that we need to do now to get it to a point to say, is this even viable? Do we want to unleash this thing into actual decision-making? Anyway, so yeah, so I think all of this needs to be taken with a grain of salt. That it is, it's like having a friend who reads tarot cards at parties. It's like, sure, they gave you some what are called Barnum statements. They gave you some things that sound vague enough that they might sound good or they might seem predictive, but it's very rare. I don't know that friend. Even the friend would claim that they are truly channeling the fates into a deterministic future.
But it's even worse in the sense of more fraught and more dangerous, right? Because when you talk about the tarot readers and the vague statements, the statements are vague and you make of them what you want. With models, you get the actual predictions. And as we've seen with a lot of issues, you think of the COVID pandemic, whenever you bring models into the system, well, you see it in economics all the time. You bring models, yeah. The models will say, oh, this is going to happen. Oh, inflation is going, if you increase interest rates to 5%, inflation is going to fall to 3% this quickly. And then you can very quickly be proven wrong. So they're even more dangerous. But this is what I wanted to go in the following sense. You've been very clear and very frank in telling us these are the potential applications. These are some of the early gains that we can have. For example, your hospitality case, where this is where we can start applying the system, or this is how we can start helping education and upskilling. My question, Rob, is what are, in terms of moving us forward towards more and more ambitious goals, what are the steps? What are the main difficulties right now, and what are the steps going forward?
Well, so in this world right now, we've had our first sort of mini AI boom. And a lot of that were people trying to use the technology to very quickly set up sort of microservices, things that you could, like my lawyer example, you give it your case, it looks at the case, it asks what state you're in, it gives you looks at all the relevant history, and it makes some kind of declaration that in a voice confident enough that it's worth paying $89.95 or whatever you were charged for it. You know, it has to sound like it really knows. You should sue. You're going to win that case. And that's what you're paying for, this, well, a lot of these services, you're paying for this sort of sense of certainty in what are almost always very uncertain, you're on uncertain ground using an unproven, uncertain technology that is essentially a giant Markov chain that is designed to produce the statistically safest or in some cases least interesting output, right? So a lot of those businesses, I think once things like the ChatGPT skills came out, or the GPTs, where you could quickly kind of build this sort of microservice yourself and then release those, and they have a little marketplace for them, growing marketplace for them, that sort of quieted down the, like, let's set up a company in a weekend using AI and try to raise, like, that world slowed down. I think the things that we need to figure out are who are the people, whether the tech companies, the like tech companies like Meta, or sort of the AI service providers like OpenAI, or the game engine people like Epic, who are the people who are taking this seriously? Because, I mean, right now, the world model, you're seeing, as I said, we're seeing a lot of work in the sort of envisioned reality space where, you know, using video to produce video, and then video that's sort of just exists. Just, I want to see a rhinoceros swimming in a swimming pool. Boom, there it is. That has whatever utility it has. I'm not terribly threatened as a storyteller by that process anytime soon, but I do think that the simulation model will have the ability to kind of produce narratives, again, that for me, at least right now, sit next to human-authored narratives. I don't think we're going to get the depth or richness out of like a complex story out of any one of these systems. But again, it comes down to like, who is really betting on that this is going to work? And I'm sure there are plenty of people writing Medium posts, and there's certainly people who work in tech who have made statements about things like world models and stuff like that. But I don't know of, at least, and maybe that I'm not adequately researched on the topic, I don't know of anybody who's really put their money where their mouth is, so to speak, to say, we're going to spend potentially hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, that it's going to require to really solve this problem in a 10-year time frame. In the meantime, I will continue to make video games and try to attack very small pieces of this and learn as much as I can. But there, and I'm sure, that, like I said, there are clues, things like I mentioned before, Meta's Horizon platform and the ability to kind of analyze people in a more embodied human-like virtual environment where data is a lot more easy to hoover up. There are clues that people are thinking in this way, but yeah, there's no world model project with, yeah, we need something like CERN for simulation. I think that's really what this comes down to.
It's fantastic. It's been a fantastic conversation, Rob, and it really brings home how with this searching of simulations into AI simulation-powered worlds, we are moving forward the universe of gaming. But again, unsurprisingly, we've always, in humanity's history, we always learned a lot by playing. So I think you've given us some very fascinating examples of how these improved gaming frameworks can take us forward in the hospitality industry settings, in the space exploration potentially, certainly in policy making. So it's been a really fascinating conversation, which has opened up a lot of exciting opportunities for the future and a lot of potential problems and difficulties. Give you the last word to wrap up, Rob. Is there anything that we haven't touched upon, anything that you would like to leave the audience with?
No, I think actually I was very happy with my closeout. And the last thing, we really should be thinking about this as a nation scale problem or a coalition of nations or a global scale problem, because every nation, every culture, every people needs to be meaningfully accounted for in these worlds, right? We can't only create sort of simulation and exploration within a certain pocket. It's like the Northeastern United States, that's not going to work. I mean, the utility of that is obviously really limited. So because we need to be as inclusive as possible in creating these models, it's important that on a global level that this problem be worked on, be contributed to by the incredible depth of talent that exists on a global level. And that's testament to that is we're seeing papers come from, I mean, if you're following AI papers or there's various channels, social channels, two-minute papers, things like this, they're coming from everywhere. It's really an amazing, yeah, it's definitely a new field with sort of a new set of really passionate and intelligent and thoughtful people who are working towards kind of the solutions towards what will be these massive global scale problems. So I do think we need some kind of United Nations of simulation. This is something at least to think about.
The United Nations of Simulations. This is a great way to end the episode. Rob Otten, founder and CEO of Hexagram, thank you so much for being on the podcast with us today. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactored business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts, and you can always learn more or apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everybody.